welcome, you amazing separation anxiety goddess, you.
Way to set me up for being all like blushy and embarrassed.
I was just telling her that, like, you're kind of a big deal and you should recognize it. So what better way to get started by sharing with the listeners a little bit about you and how you found your awesome niche of separation anxiety?
Okay. Well, that's a fun question. I was in corporate America many eons ago, and due to a challenge that happened with one of my pets passing away, I decided, no, I'm going to have a whole new change in my life. And I went and did some research and decided to pivot to dog behavior and training, and went through the Academy for Dog Trainers with Jean Donaldson. That was 22 years ago. Oh my gosh. I know, I'm old, honey.
Time flies when you're having fun, though.
There you go. And boy, have we had some fun into those years. So shortly after I graduated from the academy, I got a referral for someone referred a client to me that had a dog that was suffering with separation anxiety. And this was back in the day when people just called you and said, hi, that doesn't happen anymore. So the phone rang and I just picked it up. This was like pre-caller ID practically, you know, so I don't know who I'm about to talk to. Anyway, this lovely woman, and she starts to tell me about her dog Guinness, and that Guinness was having a really difficult time staying alone. And I thought to myself, wow, I know the basic principles about how to work with this issue, but I am a very green trainer. Like this is above my pay grade.
Right.
And so I told her that, you know, I understand what you're going through and I know this is a challenge and I'd like to refer you to other trainers that are more qualified than I am. And suddenly she burst into tears on the other side of the phone. And she said through like her little hiccupy, choky tears, will you please refer me to someone that will work with separation anxiety? Because you are the seventh trainer that I've spoken to and no one will work with me.
Right.
And my first thought was, wow, what a dedicated individual. Like you've got seven previous trainers saying, I don't work with separation anxiety. That for many people would be like red flag. This is not an issue that people know how to deal with. And the fact that she just continued and was searching. So I made a decision because she just was so lovely. And I said, well, look, in all transparency, I'm a very green trainer. I will do my very best. But if we get in over our heads, we're going to have to, you know, refer out to a veterinary behaviorist or something like that. And she said, oh my gosh, I would be so thrilled. So fast forward, we worked together for a little bit. And Guinness became very successful in staying home alone without any distress. And I was in a really small community in San Francisco Bay Area. And so the moment people heard that I had resolved, let's call it, this separation anxiety case, like word got out and everybody was like, that is the least likely behavior that I want to deal with.
Right.
So I don't know who I'm going to refer this to now. And so that's kind of how it all began. However, I will say a big caveat to that. I kind of felt full of myself in that first few weeks, right? I was like, I resolved this case.
Yeah, amazing.
And then my very second case, which came in as a referral, crashed and burned. And I used all the same methodologies that I did with Guinness. And I made a decision right then that I would have to either learn how to work with this behavior issue in a really efficient and effective way, or I would need to be one of the many trainers that would say, I don't work with that issue.
Right, right.
And I spent about the next 10 years working very closely with full transparency with many hundreds of clients, learning what was the most efficient and what was not efficient and not helpful in these cases. And it was a long ride, but I learned so much.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people, we'll get more into this, but I think, especially since we're both behavior professionals, I think a lot of people throw the word separation anxiety. I know there's separation distress. Again, people don't even usually recognize the different types, but it is a word that's thrown around a lot, and there are different severities, like there are with every behavior issue, but severe separation anxiety is challenging as fuck. Again, there's help out there. She has such like so many amazing resources, and we both have success stories. So we're not trying to make you feel not like there's resources, but I also understand, I understand why you were in that position, but I also understand why those trainers and why some trainers still, because I say on this podcast all the time, we all have different skill sets.
100%.
None of us can do everything. And if someone's saying that, that's a pretty easy way to maybe get another opinion. Just a general red flag. So, but I probably would have done the same thing you did. And I just love that story. And again, you were fully transparent with the client, because their management and things, a lot of us with our background, even if we weren't maybe super fluent in managing separation anxiety, there are things that you could do to at least help and at least listen to the client. So I love, and 20 years ago, I mean, I can't imagine how there was probably no resources on for you to even want to learn more. So a lot, obviously a lot of our jobs are learning on the job. We learn with every client, every animal we work with. But unfortunately, and that's back then, you probably couldn't even like, hey, I'm going to call another colleague and get feedback, or I'm going to like read some books. And you're so amazing because, again, you kind of took that and you're like, what's up, challenge? Bring it.
And you're right. And it was pretty isolating. It wasn't like, let me like convene with all of the people that work with this regularly day in and day out and see what they're doing that's most helpful. Like there wasn't that resource. But I loved it. I enjoyed it. I'm a geek when it comes to data. I was a statistician in my previous life.
Oh, how meant were you to be working with separation anxiety? Oh,
I know. God. And so I just collected data upon data upon data and figured out, oh, these things aren't really as helpful, or oh, these things really can make a difference. And it was a fun ride. It's been about almost 10 years since I took that knowledge that I'd gained in the first 10 or 12 years and started to teach others how to work with this issue. So
love it. And for, because again, I kind of mentioned people loosely threw that word around, but could you define to the best of your ability, because every animal is an individual, every situation is different. Always that is applied to everything on this podcast, but
that's right.
Can you define separation anxiety to the listeners who may not be as familiar?
You bet. You know, if I had my druthers, we would change the name of this issue, because
language matters.
It's really not accurate. And I would call it something like alone time phobia. And one of the things that I think is important that we recognize is that this is like a phobia, wherein it is completely irrational to those that are not experiencing it, but very, very real to the individual that is, which in this case is the dog. And it just does seem so irrational. Like the number of times, if I could collect a nickel for the number of times that a potential client says to me, but I come back every time, I'm always returning. So it doesn't make logical sense to us, but fears like that and phobias like that are truly characterized by how irrational they are. I mean, how many people would you say, I don't know, to pick a random phobia, are like terrified to fly on an airplane, when statistically we know that the more likelihood of becoming injured is in a car? You know what I mean? So these fears and phobias don't always have logic applied to them. But at the end of the day, dogs that suffer with this issue are terrified. They're terrified. And I think it's really important that people understand that, because it's very common as your average pet guardian to say, oh, I need him to stop barking, or he's pooping on the carpet when I'm gone, or he's tearing up my stuff, or whatever the issue may be when alone. And they're like, we need that to stop. And before we can stop that behavior, we need to address the underlying emotions of fear. Right. And so that empathy that needs to happen on the client side, saying, okay, I'm frustrated because I got the complaint from the neighbors and I have to clean up pee when I come home. I get that. That's one piece of the emotion. But the other piece needs to be, but I'm very concerned about my dog and the tremendous anxiety that he or she is experiencing.
Right. And I think even if you are, and this is where animal welfare and veterinary professionals who aren't behavior consultants can really make a difference. Because if a client mentions, like, in whether it's in passing or at a vet appointment, that I come home and he destroys everything, and that may not be separation anxiety. We're going to get video because we love some data and we should not be assuming things. But that's where you can maybe touch on, there's Fear Free and a lot of other organizations, including my amazing guest, have tons of resources. But I think just helping the client simply understand that your dog's not being a dick, and helping them understand that there's a function to behavior and that dogs may destroy things or defecate out of fear as a way to cope with severe stress. You just saying that is going to be life-changing. And then when they do find a behavior professional or veterinary behaviorist that they can work with, we are already starting to kind of change the narrative in the client's head. So they're more likely to actually reach out, like your amazing first person who, again, yeah, you're right, seven trainers. And because separation anxiety, once the client recognizes the symptoms, it's also really isolating to the clients. I think
it is.
Yeah. Can you talk about that just a little bit? Because I think that that's a big part. I have two severe separation anxiety cases, and no, they are not my favorite personally, but that's okay. Everybody's okay. I can't have everything be my favorite, but the caregivers are amazing, but also I don't think people recognize, especially in these severe cases, which many are, because by the time the client maybe recognizes the severe, it's been going on for a very long time. So can you just touch on, like, the isolation that the caregivers are going through, just so we can also have empathy as animal professionals?
Very, very important. I'm so glad that you brought this up. You know, when I started to teach dog professionals to work with separation anxiety, I sat down to write a curriculum, and the biggest piece that kept coming to my face was client communication, client collaboration, empathy for the client, client support, cheerleading, motivating, validating feelings, because this is hard stuff. And not only is the client feeling incredibly isolated simply because they're like, I can't leave my dog alone because he chews up my stuff. For that reason, I mean, which is a huge one, they're also typically feeling very isolated because your colleagues and your mother-in-law and the people at the park and they're all saying, oh, just let him cry it out, or oh, you're spoiling him, and that's why
throw him in a crate, and then they
throw him in a crate and he'll get over it,
right?
And so they commonly, even when they start working with a skilled, experienced behavior consultant on separation anxiety, that's like their lifeline. That's the only person that is helping make sense of all of this to them, because they're constantly hearing from naysayers, you know, things like, you've been at this for how long and you're only at 13 minutes of alone time, or, you know, these kinds of things, right? And so the level of client support that is, I think, required to work with these cases is really high. And the understanding, the compassion and empathy that we need to extend to these clients to help them get through this process. And in a continued reminder that this is temporary. You know, people say all the time, I just couldn't do it. Oh my gosh, you know, blah, blah, blah. But remember, we're not asking you to implement this kind of training for the next 15 years of the dog's life, right? We're thinking in terms of months. And I think it's important if we can recognize that I'm putting in all of this tremendous work emotionally and otherwise, but there is an end point to this.
No, I think that is so important to remind clients of in all contexts, or your friends. This emotion is not forever. Just from a mental health standpoint, that's something that I have learned through therapy. Like, cool, you're angry right now, sick. Like, I'm angry because, and this will pass, or whatever instead of ignoring it. So right. I think that that, and also something I always tell clients, whether it's inter dog aggression or inter cat aggression, like a few months, which we can't guarantee, but like generally a few months for a lifetime of your animals getting along, or a lifetime where you feel, guys, when you like say it like that, yes. The client now you need to remind them. That's why we take data. I always tell my clients, like, we can go. I was at a house oiling case, and I'm like, if you want to go outside and just yell fuck with me, let's do it. I just can't have you doing it in front of your cats.
Yeah, exactly.
Because this is frustrating. And you, like you said, validating. Clients always laugh. Their body language softens. And they're like, she gets it. And because I'm like, this is, and everyone, and a few clients have actually taken me up on that offer. Respect.
Mad respect.
Yes, mad respect. Or they may want to say fudge. I respect people that may not be as into cursing as I am. But I love that you mentioned that. And then some common symptoms, right, that maybe, let's say, because again, this is for my awesome behavior professionals out there, but also animal welfare, veterinarians, vet techs. What are some common symptoms that they may hear from the client, right? Or they can then talk to the client about that may be indicative that we should get more information, and this may or may not be separation anxiety that right. we see in our dog friends.
What's so interesting about separation anxiety is that there are many things that could potentially present similarly. And so if the client comes in and says the dog is, like your example earlier, the dog's chewing up my stuff, destroying things, that is a little kind of a moment. And so in the three most commonly reported symptoms are vocalization, elimination, and destruction. Now, those are the three most commonly reported. I will say, unless we have video, and I have some hilarious video, by the way, I have some very challenging video, but I have some hilarious video of dogs having a total party when they're home alone and just destroying stuff. And I'm like, yeah, that's not separation anxiety. That's a bored dog or a dog that needs a little more enrichment and exercise, et cetera. But we need to see the sort of the whole picture, because the dogs may, it's their whole body that is letting us know, right? If we've got a dog that's just happily chewing on the table leg with a relaxed hip roll to one side, that's a very different picture than the dog that is ripping up the carpet in front of the door while trembling, drooling, et cetera.
Yeah.
And I think I still to this day find this fascinating, because in the last 4 decades, separation anxiety has been the number one most researched behavior issue in dogs, above aggression even. So we have a lot of research. And there's, of course, depending on how they measure it, et cetera, but the research shows somewhere between 22 and about 50% of pet dogs in the U.S. suffer from this, some sort of alone time behavior issue. So it's quite prevalent. I do think that even with the number being that high, I think that there are a lot of dogs whose alone time distress is going unrecognized, because if they're only drooling or only pacing or only trembling the entire time when left alone, it's not necessarily noticed or understood by your average guardian. And what's been fascinating to me is in the last, well, maybe more than just since COVID, but particularly since COVID, when yeah. everybody learned how to use Zoom and everybody bought a camera, and now people are recognizing that, oh, maybe I should watch and see what my dog does when he's alone. And we're starting to see, which I think is exciting, we're starting to see more clients reaching out to us saying, I'm not getting complaints from the neighbors. My dog doesn't destroy stuff and he doesn't pee on the carpet, but I'm watching him and he is upset and I need help with that. And I think that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. And that's, I was literally just talking to one of my behavior friends the other day about, because we were asked to like be quoted in an article, and they were, I'm sure you've seen these too, where they're like, separation anxiety is a thing. And all of us in the training world are like, hey, headlines, this has been a thing for a very long time. I'm stoked that people are recognizing it. But what I'm seeing in media, they're acting as if COVID caused separation anxiety. And again, it's interesting, but also I find it problematic because it's been a problem for a very, very long time. It's just exactly what you said. Clients happen to be at home because they had to be for safety. And they recognize, even if they don't understand body language, when your dog is excessively drooling or when you leave the room or whatever, it's you. They may not be able to tell us exactly how the dog's feeling, but they're like, this doesn't feel right.
Doesn't feel right. Yeah.
And that's where I think smartphones and cameras are, guys, I'm so stoked that they're things in the behavior world because.
I know it is. I will tell you, I've been using online tools since 2009 to work with separation anxiety. So I haven't done in-person separation anxiety work since prior to 2009. And the change in my ability and or anyone's ability to help with a dog that's suffering like this now, because we have the technology that allows us to watch in real time. You know, when I first started, I used to lug my huge 8mm video camera around with me. And I had like 5 or 10 of them. And I would leave it at the client's house and I would ask them to record when alone. And then at the end of the week, I would pick up the big VHS tapes and I would
review
them.
That is amazing.
And it's kind of funny. It kind of dates me, obviously, but now I can log in and watch the dog in real time, as can the client. And that is a game changer.
Just a fun, nerdy question. What are your favorite, because cameras are so much more affordable now. What are your favorite cameras for, and where do you feel like clients enjoy they work the best, the cameras that they could purchase online for whether they just want to check in on their dog or we're doing separation anxiety work? Because I'm sure you have lots of opinions because you've dealt with many of them.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think the ones that fall into my quote favorites category are ones that give, that allow for sort of 360 or at least 180 rotation that can track, or you can move the camera with your smartphone. And so that's great. I really like, for many clients, ones that will provide notifications. So noise or movement notification, it'll notify the client, particularly as we get later on in the protocol. And I don't want the client watching their dog for 2 hours. I want them to simply check in once in a while. And if there's a notification, look to see if there's any concern to be had. Wyze camera is one of the most popular for our clients. And I think because it has a lot of those features, and it's also a really like reasonably priced camera, because there's some great cameras out there that are very expensive that don't do a whole lot more than some of the lesser priced ones.
Yeah, I love those too. But I was like, I have to get her. And I love my Furbo so much, but I know they can be a little more expensive than the Wyze cameras. And we have to meet our clients, of course, financially. Everyone's in a different place. So thank you for sharing those beautiful tips. And then you knew I was going to mention this. Can we just touch on for just a minute, cats? Because as people, especially I work with a lot of cats. And unfortunately, I understand we don't have as much research, but I don't feel like it's addressed much at all. And I definitely work with many cats who are experiencing symptoms that would fall under the category, see, being careful,
good.
Separation anxiety. Could you just touch on that for just a moment?
You know, it's funny that you asked this, and I assumed that you were going to bring this topic up. It's funny that you asked it. Just so happens to be that a couple of days ago, I met with a client who is a veterinarian, and her dog is suffering with alone time behavior issues. And we kind of went off on a tangent because she had like 7 cats running all over the place in the background. And we were talking about her cats, and she's got this like whole wall full of every type of enrichment that you could ever imagine. And I think that, as you said, we don't have enough research yet. We don't know enough to know enough. But I think that one of the reasons that we don't yet know exactly what happens when a cat is experiencing some sort of alone time behavior issue is that it's even a challenge, and you tell me if I'm wrong, it's even a challenge to the perception of cats as a pet.
I understand where you're going.
Commonly, I want a cat because I don't have time for a dog type of thing.
Right. There's a misconception societally.
Correct.
Not that people don't. I always joke when I'm lecturing, we love cats so much, yet we, as a society, everybody, not all of you individual amazing people, but as a society, we misunderstand them every year more on purpose, it feels like. It's a joke, but it's because cats bring us so much joy. Cats are such popular pets, yet we've worked as the general public, like, as you mentioned, more people are more empathetic toward dogs. There's less narratives and stereotypes with cats. Like, cats are mysterious and aloof. I could literally leave for 3 days with a big bowl of food, like a Mickey Mouse cartoon. And that's a very real feeling that some caregivers until they talk to one of us and we help educate them, and they're so open and willing and happy to receive that information. But I think that's a really good point. And I think that's most likely why maybe even the funding isn't going into that research, and cat research on its own. There's a lot of, you need funding, you need people. It's not as simple as we need more information on this topic. Some random person go. It's complex, but I do think both of us commonly, because we're assessing videos for other behaviors, right? And I start to take note of, again, some of these behaviors, like the cat sits at the door that the client left out of, not for a minute and meows, right? Vocalizes for 45 minutes. That is to me a pretty big and then I just start applying management that I would do similarly to a dog, even though a cat's a cat, a dog's a dog. So I just wanted to touch on that. The separation anxiety goddess agrees with me.
Cats 100% agrees. 100% agrees. And I hope to see more direction from a research standpoint, as complicated as it is. I hope to see more of that, because I will say, and something that you mentioned earlier, the whole news media, you know, separation anxiety is going to be the epidemic post-pandemic type of signs, right? And while that was fraught with issues from the get-go, it did raise awareness
for sure.
And what we need on the cat side is raising awareness so that people will at least recognize that there could be a possible behavior issue and watch their cat on video or on their phone or something, and just to make sure that we're meeting those cats' needs, and those needs include some behavior support around alone time.
Love it. And I love you, because I think language is so important, and I'm totally gonna not call it separation anxiety anymore. And I'm going to use that term. I think it's beautiful and I love it. So thank you for already giving me a tool to use in the future to be better. I appreciate you. So we talked a little bit about the prevalence of separation anxiety, why we have to be empathetic towards clients as animal professionals, how we can help, but as well as some common symptoms. Can we address some common myths that maybe even well-meaning animal welfare professionals, because they're missed, maybe telling people or care, again, like you said, that neighbor that means well, but whoa, they mean well, but the advice they're giving is very problematic, which is why the clients are crying by the time they talk to us, because we're the first people to actually listen to them. Can you talk about, there's so many, but let's say your three top myths that you hear, and talk about why those myths maybe were created and essentially why they're myths.
Yeah. I think the number one, if you listen to nothing else on this podcast, hear this little section here. The number one thing that I am trying to get information out there for people is, this is not your fault. Clients need to absolve themselves of the guilt that somehow they've caused this issue. And I think this was born many, many, many years past, through a variety of channels, where dog behavior, even prior to that, children's behavior was blamed on the caregiver. Your child wouldn't act that way if he or she weren't say spoiled or whatever they're applying to that. And then that was carried over into our dog behavior world, wherein if you are doing A, B, C, and D, that is causing your dog to suffer with this issue. And I just, if nothing else, I want people to recognize that they have not, like, you know, there's some brilliant research on this about spoiling activities. And for anybody listening, spoiling to me equates loving your dog, right? Not in the bad word.
Yes.
So their spoiling activities were listed as things like sleeping in the bed with you or cuddling on the couch with you or giving lots of treats or taking the dog out on errands with you or talking to them like they're a person or like they're, you know, a child. There were so many that were researched in that study, and none of them, none were causational nor correlational. So I think it's so important that we recognize that what we know about what causes separation anxiety, even though we have four decades of tons of research, we don't know a whole lot about exactly what causes the issue.
Right. And so many things affect behavior, genetics, learning history, nutrition, like it's a bizarre, it's a very long list.
That's exactly right. So I think that is the one myth. If I had to, if someone were to say you can only choose one, that is the one that I always want to talk about, because quote unquote owner blaming is just, it just does not have a place in our world. Whether you're a professional saying, well, if you didn't do this, or, you know, the reason that your dog is doing that, no, there's no place for that. And these guardians really need to be validated and recognized for taking the important steps to help their dog. So
I 100% I love it. And I think also there's a lot of danger. First off, I 100% agree. Caregivers love their animals. We all know, whether we're working in vet med or behavior or even animal welfare, I see the love that people have for their animals, even when they're struggling, and they immediately put blame on themselves for everything. And we need to, again, that support is so important. But also, I mean, I've worked with clients, and I'm sure you have, because of that cultural fog, as Susan Freeman says, that's in the media, that they're like, my dog is essentially, you know, if I was to compare it to humans, is having a panic attack about a thunderstorm, but I can't console them because I'm reinforced that you can't reinforce emotional states. But anyways, or we see people who are like, I have a loving relationship with my dog, which it's very normal to hang out with them a lot, to give them things they enjoy. That's not spoiling. That's normal. But clients actually feel shamed or are shamed by other people for that. So I love that you brought, I mean, that is a very huge myth, but also I think it's horrible because we're guilting the caregiver, which is never appropriate, no matter what you're doing. But also it's so dangerous because it's causing people to either feel unsure or feel shame about essentially having a loving, normal relationship with their animal. And that's just heartbreaking to me and to you, of course.
Yes. Yes. I'm so glad that you asked about myths, because I every time I have an opportunity to talk about that particular one, I'm so grateful to be able to share that information. I think it even goes a step further, which I'll choose as sort of my second myth. It's sort of like myth 1.5. But there's still information out there, and there are still practitioners that believe that somehow separation anxiety is about hyper attachments. And what is concerning about that, if I am told that I am hyper attached, say, to my dog, what is the result? What would I do in order to not be hyper attached? And the answer to that is what is still out there from an information standpoint today, is that we need to break the bond. We need to sever the relationship somehow. We need to start ignoring the dog, removing affection unless earned, and all these things. And that one hurts my heart.
Yeah, I love that you brought that up, because I think I use a lot of human analogies because I love humans and animals, but we are conditioned to be all about ourselves, humans. And I always tell clients, like, I have a healthy, loving relationship with my partner. So if I came home and just didn't even acknowledge him, like didn't say hi, didn't like already. So that's one interaction already. That's, I feel horrible. He's like, what is happening? And then let's say I just ignore him for one day. That is, oh my, like, I can't even imagine doing that. Like if I'm coming home and I'm going to be on a work call, I literally text my partner and say, I'm not trying to be rude, or with friends too. Like I left my friend's house quickly because the pizza place was closing in 15 minutes yesterday. And I told them that. But then when I got home, I texted and just said, I'm sorry again for like leaving. The pizza place was closing in 15 minutes. And that's just heartbreaking to think that, like you worded it so well, that people are being encouraged to damage the bond, but that they love. Like they don't want to do that, but they're being told, maybe by an unexperienced, maybe unevidence-based person, or maybe they, again, their friends meant well, sent them 5 articles and blog posts, and that's just heartbreaking. So that needs to be on a t-shirt, but we have to come up
with that thing. We need to, for sure. Yeah, that one's a tough one. And as a result, you know, one of the big myths that's out there is that you have to use a crate for a dog that is suffering with this issue. First of all, that is a no, and that is a hard no. Okay. And I want to preface that by saying crates have their place, you know, confinement and crates have their place for, you know, if you're going to go to an agility trial, well, you got to have your dog in some sort of confinement while the other dog, you know, there's and safety and for travel or things like that. I mean, there's obviously reasons that confinement may be necessary at times, but one of them is not because they are suffering with alone time behavior issues. And oftentimes that gets born out of, we have to break this bond kind of thing, and therefore put your dog in, get your dog into a confinement space away from you so that we can, you know, and boy, is that still being recommended often today as some sort of resolution for separation anxiety. And we have a mountain of evidence that shows that not only is it not helpful or effective in resolving these dogs' anxiety, in many cases, we're actually exacerbating the problem.
And unfortunately, because I'm sure you see these things and are as triggered as me, I see the things that are being marketed, right? Oh. I see these crates being marketed as indestructible. Hey, guys, when your animal is in fight or flight and think they're, whether it's a thunderstorm, whether it's separation anxiety, they are terrified and in some cases feel like they're going to die. Just like me, even though it may not be a rational phobia, as she already mentioned, it's a very real one. And I will break through some shit. If I think so, this, when I see things like indestructible and these crates that are being, again, inappropriately advertised and marketed, it just, to the kind of myth that you touched on, like, we love crates. There is a point to them. We both teach crate training, but as a solution of your dog's pooping everywhere, we're not going to address the underlying function. We're going to throw him in a cage and then we're going to put 4 locks on it. And then he literally physically harms himself getting out of it. It's just something, unfortunately, we see a lot. So I love that. And then from a marketing standpoint for caregivers, they're being misled. So I have empathy for them. Again, these, and just, I get so triggered. I report every ad I see when it comes up.
I love that you do that. I do the same.
I report it as misleading or scam.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
It makes me feel better. See something, say something. Yes, it's small, but we both see how problematic and how many animals suffer due to that narrative. And then, of course, with animal suffering comes human suffering. So a crate is not a solution to separation distress, or, I wrote it down so I don't forget, alone time behavior issues.
That's right. Alone time behavior issues.
So I know we could talk about myths forever, but to kind of provide some resources on, because again, you can't necessarily, just like you can't prevent every behavior issue. That's just not possible. But for animal professionals out there, as a what techniques and suggestions would you have to help set animals up for success, to set them better up for the likelihood that they won't experience separation anxiety? Because again, it's not as simple as you do ABC, this doesn't happen. That's not how I always say, my mom is awesome, but I still have a fuckload of stress. And my clients eat, like, because they blame themselves. And I'm like, my mom's great. And there's environmental stress. And then they instantly understand. So yeah. What advice would you give to those animal welfare professionals, especially who aren't in the behavior world? And maybe they're at a puppy or kitten appointment as a vet tech, and they're doing their behavior spiels, or a puppy or kitten kindergarten class at a shelter. What would you recommend?
Yeah. And I love, just want to point out that you said, you know, set them up for success, or set them up, you know, for the best opportunity. I want to get rid of the word prevention in our industry, because
I agree. Yeah.
It is so laden with, you did everything wrong, therefore your dog has an issue, or you didn't follow my directions, therefore your dog has an issue. And that's what prevention sort of signifies, that, oh, there is a way to completely eliminate the possibility of this happening. And that is not the case. I think that we really need to think about optimizing our dogs for alone time success. And when we're talking about puppies or kittens, or really any age, but you know, that's most commonly when this conversation comes up. And I'm often told, well, they're puppies, so they're going to cry, or they're going to whine, or they're going to, and I think it's really interesting that discussion still continues today. Just because it's a young plastic being doesn't mean it's okay for us to allow them to be in distress. And so commonly the advice, particularly for puppies, is they're a puppy, they're going to cry, let them cry it out, they'll be okay. And boy, can that be extremely physiological and psychologically damaging for animals. Here's what's, I think, super cool. If we take the time with our young animals and we expose them in very small increments to something that currently is a neutral stimulus, like alone time, right? They haven't learned it yet. They don't know anything about alone time yet. So why not say, I'm going to take out the trash and watch how my puppy does. If that was too hard for my puppy, then I'm going to back it up. If that was successful for my puppy, I'm going to allow for those 5-minute absences, you know, for a couple of days, and then I may increase it. And people will often say to me, so you're kind of talking about a separation anxiety protocol. And in a way, it is a modified separation anxiety protocol. It's kind of an accelerated one. The great news, though, is if in 2-3 weeks, and I do mean 2-3 weeks, I mean, obviously there's no exact timeline. These are all individuals. But if in a handful of weeks, we're like, oh, puppy is comfortable now with when I run to the grocery store. Great. Guess what you did? You set that puppy up with a metaphorical soft place to land when it comes to alone time. And now they're fine with it. If in that handful of weeks, the puppy is still struggling, guess what? You're a few weeks ahead of the game, because you've been gradually and carefully exposing them to something that may be a bit of a challenge to them. And so you know, you're already ahead of the game, because if we did it the other way and said, well, let's just leave them and let them cry it out and see how that goes. Boy, are we taking a big risk. And a few weeks down the line, we will be way further in trouble if the animal has been rehearsing that fear for weeks upon end. So I love exposing, you know, young animals to tiny, tiny bits of the thing that could potentially be scary. And I don't see that letting a puppy cry it out, or, you know, be in any sort of distress is a viable or appropriate decision to make.
Yeah. I think there's tons of research with babies, infants.
Yes.
And in the 1950s and 60s, woo! That's, again, we're all getting better as human beings, which I love. We're all improving. I focus on the positive, and I genuinely think that even though it can be challenging at times in the climate that we are in now, generally people want to do better. But you see what people were told in the 1950s to do with their children. And that thankfully, it was along those lines. And yes. Thankfully, that has changed, not just only in the advice, but also based on the research.
That's right.
So I think, again, using these analogies, explaining to people, and as an animal professional, even if you aren't the behavior consultant that you may be referring to, these are things that you can address these myths. And it is life. You have so much power. I tell this to you guys all the time. You have so much power and influence. Every interaction you have with a human being, just like every interaction you have with an animal, matters. And as a vet tech or someone working in animal welfare or a veterinarian or a veterinary assistant or a CSR, you have opportunities to make such a big difference in humans and animals' lives. And it could just be saying, like, your dog's not a dick. Animals don't feel spite. And I know that seems simple, or your dog's not being dramatic. That word is so hard for me to hear.
I agree.
Because again, there's a lot of labels that are used and the narratives are created. It can't be tested. It's just problematic. So I love that. That is wonderful advice. And I know you have so many, because really she is the separation anxiety goddess. I've read her book. I have utilized her resources. I have learned a lot because I was a green trainer at a point and I'm still always learning. And thankfully, by the time I started seeing cases, you existed and had a lot of resources. So you're making it easier for us in the future to be better and to help caregivers with this. So again, I'm so thankful for you as a person. And she's also really wonderful, genuinely. So that helps.
Oh, you're so wonderful yourself. Thank you for your kind words.
But can you share, because you have so many resources, can you share a little bit about your book, your courses, about CSATs? Because I don't think a lot of people know. I'll be honest, as a vet tech, before I got into behavior, I didn't know that CSATs existed. So can you just touch on all of that beautiful stuff?
You bet. First and foremost, from a resources standpoint, I want anybody to know that they can go to my website and there are pages and pages and pages and pages of blogs about everything you can imagine with respect to separation anxiety. I have a colleague of mine whose dog was going through separation anxiety. And as a result, she got bit by the training bug and became a trainer.
I love those clients.
I love those clients. But it was really interesting because this was quite recent. And she said, you know, I have read and reread and highlighted and tagged and post-it noted all of your blogs. And just collectively reading through those, which are free resources, she learned before finding a trainer. She really learned, like, oh, so I have to be careful of, for instance, confinement. I am not going to confine, or I have to adjust my criteria. So that is there as a free resource for anybody and everybody.
So great resource to put on your puppy and kitten packs. Great resource as a shelter to have on your website. Because again, you're planting seeds and helping those caregivers at least be heard and feel validated, but also have management while they work on finding a behavior consultant. Add it to your list.
Wow, you're the best. So there's that. The most recent book that was published, Separation Anxiety in Dogs, Next Generation Treatment Protocols and Practices. I always forget the name, but I think I got it.
Such a sexy name.
A lot of words in that name. really, it was an incredible experience to write that book. And it sounds so corny, but it was such a labor of love. And I took as much of the research as I could possibly take to pull it in. But there's also stories and support and guidance for how to work with these issues. The book was originally written with the dog professional in mind, but I cannot tell you how many dog guardians have reached out and said, well, I read your book. And so then I started to conduct my daily training. And then I did this thing that you said to do. And now my dog is okay for 2 hours or whatever it is, right? And it's really a rewarding feeling. So that book is out there. I recommend people buy the book, ebook or hard or paperback through Dogwise. Dogwise is an amazing small publishing company, and they're awesome. They're awesome.
Yeah, shout out to Dogwise. I buy a lot of books through them, and there's a lot of other great books through them.
Tons.
Too, so support small local businesses. Yes, yes, yes.
Agreed. Agreed. And then the last two resources I want to mention, I have an online self-paced course that was actually written with the pet guardian in mind. Even though we do have a lot of professionals that go in and want to learn more about separation anxiety, so they take that course. It's a very comprehensive course that has many, many modules that break down how to get to work on a separation anxiety protocol. And one of the things that I think is super, I'm very prideful about is anybody that takes that course, which is a lifetime access, you pay for it one time, and it's lifetime access. And I'll give you a discount code if you care to have that.
Oh, yes, please. We love a discount.
We love a discount. Lifetime access. And you can ask questions, post comments, and we answer those 365 days a year. Like, you are not alone in that course. And I think it's really important because we already talked earlier about how isolating it can be and how, you know, just that little bit of support saying, yeah, you're doing great, this is what you're doing is working, can go so far. So, you know, you will not be alone in that course. And that course is called Mission Possible. Everybody says impossible. No, Mission Possible.
Love it.
And then finally, we have a course for dog professionals. And it is a very intensive course. It's really more like a master's level program. And it goes for 14 weeks. There's over 100 hours of instruction. And we take some pretty deep dives. And I cannot tell you how many people have been like, oh, this is cool, I'm going to learn something about separation anxiety. And then they get into the course and they're like, mind blown. This can actually help me with all types of behavior cases. Obviously, separation anxiety is what we're talking about. But there's so many aspects to the process that can be applied for any type of behavior issue. And as a result of going through that course, successfully graduating means that you can become a certified separation anxiety trainer. And that's that CSAT that you referred to earlier. There's over 250 CSATs all over the world, almost every time zone that you can imagine. And they work one-on-one very closely on a day-to-day basis with anybody whose dog is suffering with this issue.
And they can find, so if you're a caregiver or if you want to have it as a resource, they can go to the website and find a CSAT near them or virtually, because I see clients, you know, across the country for cats and dogs. I am not a CSAT. Now I'm like, I have to add another. That sounds fun.
Yeah, you do.
But also in depth. So it's on my list. We love a list. Can they find that information on the website?
They can. We're actually right now in the process of reorganizing the CSAT page a little bit. It based on, this is like website stuff that I don't understand, but based on the way that it was set up, it wasn't really searchable. And so we're going to have some filters so that people can find people by time zone, by language spoken.
Oh, I love that.
We have a lot of French speaking, a lot of Spanish speaking. We've got German, Italian, every language, Hindi. We have so many available languages so that people can better distill how to find, because right now it's a little bit trickier to find that person without that sort of search function.
Oh, awesome. That's so exciting. And to end, you probably have thousands. And I know you shared Guinness's story, which will never not warm my heart, because we all have that animal or multiple animals that have changed our lives. I mean, I have a cat and a dog that led me down this fun world of behavior. And now I can never look back. But can you share a success story from one of your clients, one of your favorite, they're all our favorites, but one of your favorite alone time behavior issue cases?
Well, you're right. They're all my favorites. And there are some stories that I love to tell just because they're so heartwarming. But the one that I'm thinking of today, I think it's a good one to share. You know, I mentioned earlier that I, you know, came from the sort of statistics world, and data is my jam. And this was a case from several years ago, more than several now, time's flying, that I felt taught me a lot. And it, to me, this case to me, like, made me realize how valuable data tracking and data sorting can be. And this is true, not just for separation anxiety. This is true for any type of behavior case.
Yes.
So I was working with this lovely beagle, Emma, and her guardian. And we started collecting data and obviously doing day-to-day training together. And Emma started to improve and improved a little bit more and improved a bit more. And then suddenly Emma started sort of waning and kind of regressing. Now, regressions are part of learning, really. We see them. The learning is not linear, up, 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 up.
Right.
And so it wasn't like, uh-oh, something major is wrong. But so we kept working. And after a bit of time passed with, you know, some regression, Emma started to progress again and progressed and progressed. And then suddenly started to wane again and started to sort of flatten out and then regress. And so my spidey senses went up the second time this happened. And I had been collecting data like no tomorrow. And so we start, and I'm kind of a freak with a spreadsheet. I kind of know how to work my magic in a spreadsheet. But you don't need a spreadsheet to do it. But I personally love that.
Just something that I would love for you to do, not that you need more things, but selfishly, I would love this. I would love somebody fun and entertaining and intelligent like you to do like a 1-hour webinar to how to make, I collect tons of data as well, but I would love a class on it. And then to talk, I love data, but I hate spreadsheets, but I want to utilize it. Just planting a seed, I would pay the monies and I would think it would be a really helpful resource for a lot of people. But anyways.
Well, we shall return to that discussion. I have some people, not just me, people. I know a few folks. And plug for a wonderful person named Tara Hauser that has an organization called the Optimized Dog.
Ooh, I'll have to check it out.
All about data collection.
Ooh, so I love it. Okay. Cool.
So started sorting all the data, looking at it up, down, left, right, backward, forward. And started to see that there really was some sort of pattern to this progress, plateau, regress. And so started pulling things out of the data. Well, fast forward to a little while later, after playing with the data for so long, started to recognize some trends. And sometimes you don't recognize a trend until some time has passed and you're like, that seems to happen whenever that seems to be somehow correlated to when this other thing happens. Turns out that we found every, and I don't remember the exact timeline, but every 3 weeks or something, every 4 weeks, Emma would go to the vet and get her anal glands expressed and receive cold laser therapy. And guess what? After that veterinarian's appointment, Emma felt good. And she would progress. As time got further away from when she received those treatments, she was not feeling as well. And she would plateau and regress. It ended up being such a powerful case. And we came up with the number one rule of Emma is if she doesn't feel well, she's not going to be okay with alone time. And we collaborated with the vet. The vet ended up deciding to instead of just the cold laser therapy, decided to trial her on some small doses of pain meds.
Yes, exactly.
So her arthritis was discovered to be a little bit more concerning than it had been. And they created a very regular schedule for anal gland expression. And moving forward, that dog sailed through it all.
Oh, I love that story. And I love the collaboration, caregiver, veterinarian, everybody working together and data.
Right?
It's nerdy, but it's such a helpful. Yeah. I need to learn the spreadsheet life though. I'm not about it. And I think it would be a helpful tool if I just sucked it up and like really learned how to not just write it in a Word document, but in my lovely notebook. but where I could actually make graphs and stuff.
Oh, yeah. Oh, the number of graphs that we geek out on. Oh, you will. Oh, you're in for a wild ride. I'm not letting go of you now.
No, I'm excited. I'm excited because I need people that are excited about graphs to help me because I don't get as excited. But so thank you so much for sharing all your amazing knowledge and your stories. And one of the last questions I like to ask every guest is, what is something that currently makes you happy? This could be how beautiful you look today, or it can be, like I joked earlier, I'm going to have a third cup of coffee after this. It's one of those days, everybody. But what is something that currently makes you happy?
Gosh, it sounds so cliche, but I gotta go with it anyway, because it's the truth. My dog, Teeny, her name is Teeny D Martini is her name.
That's so cute.
And, we're going on 14 years, and the joy that I get I'm going to start to cry.
All the time on this podcast. I encourage, be yourself, feel your feelings. They're all important.
Yeah. She helped me tremendously because, as I said, she's about 14. So this was about 14 years ago when I brought her into my home, and she suffered with mad separation anxiety. It's irony of all ironies, right? Like, right. I really need that. She taught me a lot more than I had learned just from working with clients. And we've had a beautiful wild ride together. And she was just recently, about 4 or 5 months ago, diagnosed with Cushing's. And just a couple of days ago, we had her most recent test, and her meds are spot on. Her levels are perfect. She is feeling like a million bucks.
I love it.
And it just brings me so much joy to see her giddy and silly and fun and happy. And that's what's making me happy. The biggest thing right this moment.
Oh, I love it. Well, thank you so much. I'm sure we will have her on again. I could talk to her about all the things, and probably to talk about alone time behavior issues. See, I have to keep looking at it because it's new, but that's what I'm using now. And I love it. So thank you.
Thank you. It's been so much fun. And I appreciate your joy and your energy and your kindness and compassion towards not just pets, but all the people out there that work with them and have.